Morning.
Great. Excellent. Well, good morning, gentlemen. We are conducting this set of oral arguments this morning via Zoom. And so just remember to identify yourselves when it is your turn to speak. If you're having any technical issues of any sort, just let us know, or we'll try to let you know, or if you can't hear one of us. We have just been starting to talk, I think, when we have questions. So, and then, if you have trouble seeing the our sophisticated timing device here, but otherwise, if you're ready to start, Mr. Nestor. Oh, I'm going to call the case because our marshal's having is having some issues with sound. It's a state of Minnesota versus Edgar Galvin Contreras, appellate case number A20-0366. And appellant, as you probably already know, you have 15 minutes for argument, followed by 15 minutes for the state, and then 5 minutes of rebuttal for the appellant. So if you're ready, go ahead, identify your name for the record and start.
May it please the court, counsel, my name is Bruce Nestor, appearing and arguing today on behalf of the appellant, Edgar Galvin Contreras. Today, the state of Minnesota is seeking to convict Mr. Galvin Contreras of a felony level offense, taking the position that the interference of privacy statute does not have any specific intent element with respect to the actor's knowledge that the victim of his offense is a minor. This is a position diametrically opposed to the position that the state of Minnesota took in State v. Stevenson, 637 Northwest 2nd, 857, a Minnesota Court of Appeals case in 2002, which was ultimately affirmed on other grounds with respect to the definition of presence by the Minnesota Supreme Court. Stevenson concerned the interpretation of the subdivision of the criminal sexual conduct fifth degree statute involving lewd display of genitals in the presence of a minor. In that case, the state took the position that the crime is one of specific intent requiring knowledge that minors are present. And that was the finding of the Court of Appeals in interpreting the same language in the criminal sexual conduct fifth degree subdivision, the same language that is present in the interference with privacy statute, and that the Court of Appeals decision in Stevenson is consistent with the position taken by Mr. Galvin Contreras in this matter. Now, in support of its position, taking a different position than it took in Stevenson, the state argues that the general provision of the definition of criminal intent in Minnesota Statute 609.02 subdivision 9 parentheses 6 overrides any specific language or specific element established by the legislature in the interference with privacy statute.
Mr. Nestor, I'm going to, go ahead, Judge Ross.
I was going to say, aside from the state's position, is there a case that you were able to find where this court or the Supreme Court has held consistently with what you're saying the state argued in the Stevenson case as to what exactly the intent element attaches to?
Not with respect to the interference of privacy statute, Your Honor. I have not been able to find a specific case.
So let's look, when I look at the language, that to me is where we begin, and unless you convince me otherwise, I think where we end here, the term intent seems directly to attach to the verbs intrude upon or interfere with the privacy of the occupant. And the only mens rea element I see attached to the minority of the victim is knowledge, against the minor under age 18, knowing or having reason to know that a minor is present. Disabuse me of that distinction between those two mens rea elements.
Well, I think the second mens rea element imposes an additional element to make it a felony level offense, as opposed to it just constituting a gross misdemeanor offense under subsection D of the interference with privacy statute. And so, I
agree, that seems clear, but I'm trying to get a sense of why then one attach, why the intent element then would go back and attach, or the knowledge, or the intent element would then attach to the minority.
Well, and that's where we're looking at the language in subsection E, where the legislature included the knowing or having reason to know that the minor is present. And you can only know that the minor is present by knowing that the person is a minor. I mean, otherwise you end up in the absurd results discussed in my brief that stem from the district court's explanation as to what pair of legs you happen to observe under the bathroom partition, say. And so the district court took the position, well, if a parent and a child go into a bathroom stall and you happen to observe the legs of the minor, not knowing it's a minor, of course, that's just who you see, well, then you know or have reason to know that a minor is present because you don't need to know that the person is a minor. But, on the other hand, you would engage in the same conduct, and if you saw the parent's legs, you wouldn't be guilty of this enhanced felony level offense.
But isn't that true with any number of crimes? It's the consequence on the victim. I mean, from every level of assault. I mean, somebody can fall down and, you know, from an assault, and it can be anything from, you know, misdemeanor level up to, you know, if the person happens to hit their head in a certain way when they hit the pavement, you know, to death. I mean, there, you know, so how do you respond to that, you know, all the cases talking about, that it's not strict liability. The intent is to cause the assault. The intent is to interfere with the privacy, but the consequence is worse if there's a minor present. So we're going to punish that more heavily. The consequence is worse depending on whether it's bodily injury, substantial bodily injury, or death. I mean, that. So how do you respond to that?
So I think that's certainly true in that type of statute where your focus on increasing the level of severity of the crime based on some harm or some outcome. So for your assault, you can have the same general intent, and yet if the person suffers a substantial injury, it's a more serious offense. More closer to home, in the other statutes that criminalize sexual conduct or activity directed towards minors, there's always going to be an effect upon that minor. If you touch a minor or you solicit a minor, there's going to be an effect on that minor because of your direct contact with them. In the interference with privacy statute, there's no requirement that the minor be aware that you're intruding upon their privacy, or there's no harm to the minor that causes that special protection to attach because we're presuming a higher level of harm based on the fact that a minor is present, regardless of whether the actor knows about it or not. And so this is more like the internet solicitation case where you're actually, and you're there has to be proof that you intend to solicit a minor, not just that you have no knowledge of that at all, and where the person might actually be an undercover officer and there's no harm from that solicitation. So I think it's that under the interference with privacy statute, there's no requirement that the victim, whether a minor or not, be aware of the fact that you're trying to intrude upon their privacy. And so to the degree that the legislative intent is to protect minors, it focuses on the mens rea, the knowledge that a minor is present or that you should know a minor is present, or you should know the person present is a minor, because that then attaches a higher level penalty based upon the more egregious intent of the actor, because there is no harm required of a showing to a victim.
And Mr. Nestor, if I could jump in, I have a question, because as I read your opening brief and your reply brief, it seems that there may be a separate argument you're making in the reply brief based on Stevenson. So my question is, before the district court at the motion to dismiss stage, did you make any argument about specific intent under Stevenson?
I did not cite Stevenson specifically to the district court, but we did argue that the specific intent required was knowledge on the part of the actor that knew or should have known that the person was a minor. In other words, to focus on the intent of the actor as being worthy of that more substantial felony level punishment. And so to go back though to the state's primary argument, which focuses on the general definitional term of 609.02.9 subdivision 6, our argument would be that this general definition sets a floor. It doesn't set a ceiling, in that the legislature can clearly create an offense that does have as an element knowledge or should have known knowledge of the age of the victim. And so that the general definition in the definitional statute only sets a floor, which says that even, and it deals with that strict liability question, and just basically says even it puts the legislature on record of addressing the fact that at least for some of the criminal sexual conduct statutes, knowledge of age is not an element, because the presumption of harm to a minor is such from criminal sexual contact that we're going to criminalize that, even if the actor had a good faith belief that the victim was an adult or was not of a certain age. And that we certainly, as a society, we punish that conduct because of the harm caused to the minor, not because of the intent of the actor. The interference of privacy statute, in my view, is different in that it focuses on the intent of the actor. And ultimately, I just don't think there's any way that a reasonable person can read subsection E of the interference with privacy statute and not see that knowledge of knew or should have known the minor is present as meaning that you know the person is a minor. If the legislature—
Well, I think there is a way to read it that way. And I think Judge Ross even articulated that earlier today, that you could understand what is, what you have to know is the presence of a person, not that person's age.
But that I think then the legislature could have or should have worded it in a much clearer and different way. And that is that you commit the offense when a minor is present and you knew or should have known a person is present. Well, the inclusion of the minor basically makes it superfluous if you don't read an intent element attaching to knowledge of the minor.
Well, I'm going to push back on that a little bit. It seems to me that your argument would be much stronger if the legislature had used the indefinite rather than the definite article for, you know, the minor is present versus a minor is present. It would be clear. I think you're asking us to interpret this statute to change that word, to say that a person is guilty of a felony. If you violate the subdivision against a minor, knowing or having reason to know that a minor is present.
And I consider that, Your Honor, and that I think would be equally confusing, because then you could violate it against a particular minor, and the state takes a position that you don't even know to have that the person is present. So you could, for instance, intrude upon an elementary school bathroom, but you don't know that the minor that you're targeted, some different minor is present when you use a minor is present. It wouldn't be the same, it wouldn't match up to violate the statute against the minor, knowing a minor is present. In other words, it could be a whole separate person than the victim that is the subject of your peeping or observation. And so I don't think the language is a model of clarity, and that's not unusual for some statutes, but the best reading of it is that it means that intent and knowledge of element attaches to. And because otherwise there's just no reason for that heightened protection and that heightened punishment of a felony If you have no idea that a minor is present, and the minor does, who is present, has no idea that you're peeping or intruding upon their privacy. There's no showing of harm to a minor, and there's no showing of that additional level of bad intent to justify a felony level punishment.
So if this had been a bathroom in an elementary school, would we then have the intent, even though appellant didn't necessarily know that there was a minor in the stall next to him? I mean, you have the intent then. He's at an elementary school, just like the beach where you could see there were younger kids there. Would that change things?
Then I think, I mean, at that point, you that's where the should have known. When you do it in an elementary school and a minor is present, you don't get to argue, oh, I thought an adult was present. I didn't know that that person was a minor, because you should have known in that setting that a minor could be present. And so that's where it incorporates both a reckless element and a specific intent, specific knowledge element, where you actually know the person is a minor, or you should know because of the location or the appearance of the person.
By should have known, you mean under the statute, reason to know.
Correct. And so we'd ask the court to reverse the district court and find that under the plain language of the statute, or by applying the canons of statutory construction, that as well as following the panel decision in Stevenson with respect to interpreting the same language in a different statute, that the court should reverse the district court and find that there is a knowledge element attaching to knowledge, or should have known that the person is a minor.
And the remedy being a new trial?
No, actually the remedy would be, I believe, that the gross misdemeanor conviction would stand. It would just eliminate the felony enhancement provision, because all the elements of the gross misdemeanor statute were admitted to as part of the bench trial.
All right, thank you. Mr. Griffin, please go ahead. You'll have 15 minutes and identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Mark Griffin. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney. I'm here today representing the state of Minnesota. The relief that I'm asking this court to order is a denial of the appellant's requested relief, as counsel just put it, to reduce the conviction from the felony to the gross misdemeanor level. Two quick points I wanted to make, and then I'm certainly happy to answer any questions. Point number one, there are many crimes enacted under Chapter 609, which require the state to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the victim's age is relevant to that offense. There are no crimes under Chapter 609, literally none, which require the state to prove that the defendant knew of the victim's age in order to prove the offense that's been charged.
But are those statutes worded identically to this one as it regards knowledge, reason to know that the minor is present?
Many of them have the CSC statutes, and I do have that requirement, and I know the council has been talking about one of those, the reason to know or should have known as to the victim's age in that case. So yes, there are some of those, but the point remains, when you read any of the statutes from the beginning of Chapter 609 to the end, none of them specifically say the state must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the accused knew what the age of the victim was. So there is no statutory requirement under Minnesota law that the state would have to prove whether or not, in this case, the appellant knew the age of the person who was in the bathroom stall next to him. How do we begin
the statutory analysis on this? What presumptions, if any, do we make about, we all know that generally there's a, unless the legislature says otherwise, we begin with this presumption of a mens rea element, that there, we presume mens rea. But in this case, do we also presume that the mens rea element applies to the age of the victim, unless there's some clear statutory language to the contrary?
I think the mens rea is, I think I put this in the brief, in this particular case, the criminal intent existed from the second he stuck the cell phone recorder or cell phone camera into the neighboring stall. So that sort of distinguishes it from the strict liability argument that counsel raised. So you have criminal intent.
So you're saying there's no more need to presume any further, that the legislature presumes a second level of mens rea.
That's what I believe the case law and the statute say. Yes, Your Honor. Once there is an initial criminal intent, there is no requirement. And I think that's the Wenthe case. I think I'm pronouncing that correctly. The W-E-N-T-H-E. You don't have to add an additional mens rea on top of one when you already have one. So it's a crime to take your cell phone and stick it into a neighboring bathroom stall. That's a gross misdemeanor invasion of privacy. If the person in there happens to be a juvenile, then because of their age, whether you knew it or not, that same criminal intent, that same mens rea continues right through, even though the level of the offense is increased. Excuse me.
Mr. Griffin, it sounded like you were going to move on to another point. If so, let me ask a question. If not, I'll let you finish.
No, Your Honor, please go ahead.
In Mr. Nestor's reply brief, there's a different variety of argument that is raised that the statute as written would unambiguously include make a specific intent crime using those terms. I don't see that raised previously, and I think there's a distinction between arguing that the statute either unambiguously or ambiguously addresses a knowledge requirement and saying the statute is a specific intent crime. But I'd like you to address whether you think there's a distinction between those two and whether it was raised below.
The specific intent in knowing the age of the person in the next bathroom stall, Your Honor?
Well, in the reply brief, Mr. Nestor frames it as this is a statute that includes a specific intent crime, and the knowledge requirement is part of the specific intent. It's an element of the specific intent, or a component, I should say, of that. My question for you is, do you make a distinction between a crime, a specific intent versus general intent on one hand, and questioning what you have to know in order to commit a crime on the other? And if you do make that distinction, did Mr. Nestor properly raise this variety of argument below?
If I understand your question correctly, the initial intent for putting the phone through into the other stall, that's the initial mens rea, the initial criminal intent. That, in my argument, would be enough to sustain the conviction, regardless of whether or not he knew who was in the adjoining bathroom stall. The Stevenson case, which counsel raised, I think is distinguishable factually, if nothing else. Stevenson was...
Yeah, all right. I was just trying to get a sense from your viewpoint, whether or not you think that anytime someone questions what the knowledge requirement is, that if there's some additional or specific knowledge required, that makes it a specific intent crime? Or are you distinguishing between intent and knowledge?
I think I would have to say I'm distinguishing between intent and knowledge, Your Honor. Mainly because the intent in my argument remains the same throughout the conduct, but the knowledge can change from factual situation to a different factual situation, as we have in this case here, since he didn't know who was in the next stall. The Stevenson case that came up, I think it should be noted, it is factually dissimilar in the sense that the case reports that Mr. Stevenson was sitting in his pickup truck in a handicapped spot, and there were children 10 to 15 feet in front of him. So there was evidence in the record that he knew or should have known that there were children there. And the issue becomes, you know, are they close enough to him, or are they in his presence? Did he know or should have known that children were present when he was engaging in the lewd act that he was engaging in? So I think that Stevenson does not stand for the proposition that counsel has argued that it does, because we don't have those facts in this case. If we had a situation where the appellant knew that a young person had walked into the bathroom stall next to him, it would be more like Stevenson, but it simply isn't. And there's still, the Stevenson case still does not change either the invasion of privacy statute or the fifth degree criminal sexual conduct statute. And the Stevenson case does not create a rule of law which says the state must prove that the defendant knew the age of the victim of the offense. The going back to the chapter 609 overall, because there was a question about is there similar verbiage in other statutes, and there is, but the lack of specific direction from the enacted statutes, I think, is relevant here. The legislature could have, in any one of these statutes, added a phrase that says something like, the burden is on the state to prove that the defendant knew that the victim was under 18. It could be done in any one of the statutes, criminal sexual conduct. 609-666 is the negligent storage of a firearm, which specifically says you can't leave a gun where someone under 18 can get to it. That statute.
Mr. Griffin, as you're comparing the statutory language of other statutes to what's written or not written in this case, isn't that a step that we would take, an analytical step we would take to do that comparison, only if we found the statute was ambiguous?
Yes, that's looking at the, in pari materia argument that I made, yes, you would look at similarly intended statutes to try and discern what the intent of this particular statute is. Yes, Your Honor. But I do think it's worth noting that in the entire chapter of 609, there is no requirement in any type of statute in which victim's age is relevant to convicting someone of a crime. The state is never required to prove what the defendant knew, only that the victim was of a certain age for purposes of convicting on that crime. And I think that that can and should inform this court's decision when taking a look at the invasion of privacy statute as well.
How committed are you, Mr. Griffin, to the proposition that there is no reasonable other interpretation of the statute, that Mr. Nestor's interpretation is simply beyond any reason in the language?
I will stand with the trial court judge's decision, Your Honor, and I think that the trial court judge was correct, and I agree with that decision. The second subordinate clause relates directly to the previous clause, and it is, I think, a clear reading of that statute. The only way that it makes sense is if the second clause is referring to the first clause in terms of identifying that the person is under 18, but not that the defendant has to know that.
Assuming for the sake of argument that we're not as persuaded as you are by that grammatical approach, at what stage in the ambiguity analysis would you say, from a theoretical standpoint, do we get to the rule of lenity?
Oh. I believe what the Minnesota Supreme Court says, I'm looking for the specific phrase, grievously ambiguous, I think is what the Minnesota Supreme Court says.
You're saying we don't begin, even if we reached a conclusion that it's ambiguous, we don't jump to the rule of lenity and construe the statute against the state. We first look for various canons of construction to try to resolve the ambiguity?
Your Honor, I would say that's not my argument. I would say that that's the ruling from the Minnesota Supreme Court in the Thong-Savon case. That's specifically what they said. There wouldn't be any other canons of construction if the first one that we went to was lenity. So no, it should not be applied in this case. I'm running close to the end of my time here.
Let me ask this question, yes. Because you could look at the first section in that, you know, that lays out what a gross misdemeanor means, and the use of the term the occupant in D2, and draw a contrast between the term the minor in subsection E2. And had the legislature used the term the occupant in the second part of E2 instead of the minor, it would be more clear that that's your argument, right? But they didn't. They used the term the minor. So is there any ambiguity created by the term the minor, which could refer to the occupant or a person who is an occupant and a minor?
I understand what you're saying, Your Honor. Yes, there could be some ambiguity between the two. And if that's the case, and you don't want to accept Judge Quam's analysis.
I'm just asking you to tell me why that's not an ambiguity. I understand that the alternative arguments, we can go through statutory construction and why you might prevail. I'm just asking you, is that ambiguous to say the minor instead of the occupant?
I think that I think it does create some ambiguity, yes, and then you would, but you would refer back to the initial clause, which I think would be controlling here, even more controlling than the word occupant. So the second subordinate clause refers back to the first one, which indicates that it's the person who's in the stall, not necessarily their age. Did I answer your question, or did I just make things more confusing for you?
I think you answered it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. The last point I wanted to stress, unless there are any other questions, is that I just at least wanted to raise the Pandora's box argument very quickly. I see I'm almost out of time. If you can argue that and successfully argue that statutes that don't require the state to prove the defendant knew a victim's age, if it applies in this case, why couldn't it apply in CSC cases, in sex trafficking cases, in all the cases that are listed under Chapter 609? You could still import that analysis to other cases, and you could end up with an argument that the state would have to prove that a 14-year-old CSC victim was not only 14, but also that the defendant specifically knew that. And that is directly contrary to all the requirements under the other statutes. And I see my time has expired. I would ask that you deny the appellant's request of relief and affirm his conviction. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Nestor, you have 5 minutes.
Well, the point to respond to Mr. Griffin's last point is none of the CSC statutes, other than the fifth degree one, which was interpreted in Stevenson in a manner that I think is consistent with our argument here, none of the CSC statutes contain language that speaking of knowing or should have known the age of the victim. In fact, they specifically exclude that in the more severe CSC statutes, by specifically saying that mistake of age is not a defense, to make crystal clear in those statutes that that's not a defense. Now, that certainly is not done in the interference with privacy statute. There's no language included saying knowledge that the person is a minor is not a defense, you know, or lack of knowledge that the person is a minor is not a defense. And rather, there's at least an ambiguity there as to how that language gets interpreted. And so while I certainly would not argue that the rule of lenity is the first statutory construction that we apply, it is a rule of statutory construction that we may get to when the other ones don't resolve the ambiguity. And what a fair reading of this language is to create an ambiguity. I do believe both, I myself might be guilty of this, and I think the courts are often guilty of it. In discussing intent, specific intent, we're not always very rigorous in what we're talking about. And Judge Bryan has raised whether the issue was preserved. mean, often specific intent might not apply to a reckless element like this statute clearly has. But clearly below, the issue that was raised that the statute requires the state to prove that Mr. Galvan Contreras knew or had reason to know that the person was a minor. And that was never, the state admits it can't prove that. It has no evidence that he knew or should have known that this individual was a minor. And so, you know, certainly as argued in my reply brief, I believe that there are statutes under 609 that do have a knowledge element with respect to age that are specifically written into the statute.
What about the basic definitions of intent and knowledge that do specifically address age? And doesn't that impact our interpretation of how these terms should be defined?
I'm sorry, are you referring to the general definition that proof of age is not required?
Correct.
Decided by the state?
Correct. I mean, you have, it's not as if there's a complete silence by the legislature on this. If you have a general definition that says proof of age is not required, then if the legislator is silent in light of that general statement, we would assume that general statement would apply.
And at least the only, you know, I cannot find an application of that general intent, that general statement of the legislature. And it seems to me more consistent with that setting a floor and to deal with this question of that strict liability statutes are disfavored unless the legislature has specifically indicated that it intended to create a strict liability statute.
Again, I'm going to push back a little bit because I don't know that when we say specific liability or a strict liability statute, there is some intent for sure required here, right? The actor
Absolutely.
Has to intend to do some things here. So it's not a strict liability in that sense. It's only if you could even say this, strict liability as to age and knowledge of age. So, you know, I want to be careful that this isn't a strict liability statute. This is a statute that has intent and that has far more than a strict liability, right?
It certainly does for the gross misdemeanor offense, which is kind of the predicate offense for creating the felony. In other words, you have to commit all the elements of the gross misdemeanor offense. But to elevate it to a felony, it becomes pretty close to a strict liability offense, unless because it's whatever pair of legs you see, you're strictly liable if they turn out to belong to a minor, regardless of whether you had any reason to believe that a minor would be present. And like in Stevenson, at least, it was that the definition of proximity got so broad that it could even include knowing that you're in a place where minors are at. The state did not argue this in this case, that minors visit the fitness center and therefore he should have known a minor could be present. So it gets pretty close to strict liability.
Yeah, but you're not arguing that would be unconstitutional, right? I mean, you're arguing the language of the statute and what it means. I mean, because we've got like felony murder. You don't intend to kill anybody, but if somebody, you know, dies while you're committing a felony, you know, you're charged with murder. I mean, so the question is, you're not saying that would be a constitutional violation.
Correct.
That you're just interpreting the statute.
The legislature has the power to create strict liability statutes, but they are disfavored unless they specifically indicate that that's what they intend to do.
Okay. Yeah, that's helpful. Okay. Any further questions from the panel? No. All right. This case was very well briefed and very well argued by both sides. That's helpful to us. The case is now submitted, and we will issue a decision within the statutory timeline. And thank you both.